Get ready. Get comfy for the next Nonprofit Insider Podcast episode.
What is going on, everyone? Swim Kareem here with the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, and I am so excited to have you here. Great episode in front of you. It's super funny because I actually recorded a much longer podcast, but then I tried to upload it and my podcast writer was like, no, this is way too long. And it was only like 44 minutes, so I had to reduce a little bit. But listen, we still got a good show nonetheless. That's a little behind-the-scenes content for you all, a little informational insight peek. We got some good stuff for you. And one of the things we're going to talk about in today's episode, however, is we're going to talk about college donations. Colleges right now are having a problem with college donations, and not in the way that you think. Colleges are still getting money, but they're getting it from less and less people that, conversely enough, have more and more. It's the 1% effect. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. We're also going to talk about a really phenomenal book that I am thrilled to be talking about. Edgar Villanueva, back in 2018, came out with the book Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. And the book, for me, as a Black person in America who is in the nonprofit space, this book is gold. It's honestly, it's a classic. And I'm willing to say that because sometimes a book reverberates in such a way, and 5 years later, 6 years later, this book is still rocking. So we're going to be talking about that. Listen, be sure to follow us on Instagram. Be sure to follow us on TikTok. We got some great things going. Let me make sure I'm not missing anything. Shout out to Mariah Harrison at the ABQ Accent Podcast list. I'm going to put that in the show notes. I'm going to talk about them on Instagram a little bit. They've got some really, really good things happening. So if you're in the Albuquerque area, if you want to hear more stories from New Mexico, you want to be hashtag NM New Mexico True, this is a podcast for you to listen to. So shout out to Mariah and the great work she's doing with the city. Listen, we have a full episode. We're talking about colleges and donations. We are completely packed, so let's get into it. All right, we're back. And listen, I'm not even going to lie on this one. This might go over. I might end up spending the next 20 minutes talking about this because this is something that is talking about the centerpiece, money being the centerpiece of the nonprofit space. When it comes to colleges, a lot of my energy has been spent on the student loan forgiveness sphere. I'm a big proponent of student loan forgiveness on a couple of different areas. Now, look, full disclosure, I have student loans. If you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, I have $20,000 in student loans. I'm paying just the interest alone, I'm paying $115 a month on student loan interest. And by all respects, I have a small amount. So if I'm paying, you know, $230 every single month, half of it's going to interest and half's going to principal. Folks, I don't care who you are in this debate. Something's wrong with that. And there are a lot of aspects of the student loan debate that are really, really infuriating to me. Even though I understand a lot of people that say, hey, student loan forgiveness is, it's a cop-out in a lot of respects. Listen, I get a lot of that aspect. But even more so is I have a lot of interest in the aspects of colleges, period. Colleges have a donation problem. Colleges have a donation problem. And thinking about that previous episode topic of the news I just talked about with Reddit, if you are a fundraiser in your first 7 months, you're raising $10,000, listen, even if your supervisor is not upset about that, there's a lot of aspects to the nonprofit college and university space that is very, very big, and we need to talk about it. So look, imagine this. Imagine I buy a house from you, whether you're selling your own personal home, just like in a pure vacuum, whether you have a bunch of other properties, whatever the case may be. Imagine I buy a house from you. Imagine I buy this house from you, and 6 years later, that house is virtually worthless or doesn't even increase in value, right? Let's say I buy this house from you, and let's say I even start losing money on this house purchase in the terms of interest, right? Because maybe I have a 4% rate on this house or, you know, something like that. Let's say I make no money from this house, and let's say I start to lose money in this house. I don't get any equity from this house. I'm just like, after a while, I'm paying interest. I'm paying, maybe a little principal, but I'm losing money. And then let's say after those 6 years, you come back to me and you ask me to be in a commercial to help you sell more homes that you own. If I did that, how do you think I would feel? I would say, fuck you. Point blank. Because if I buy something from you and it's garbage and I start losing money off of it, that's one thing. But then when you come back to me and say, hey, you not only bought this house and it's garbage, I want you to be in a commercial to help me sell more homes that I own, to help me pay more of the, help you pay more of the bills that you have. That's basically colleges right now. And when I say that colleges have a donation problem, I'm not saying that they aren't getting money. Colleges and universities, whether you're at Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, whether you're at the University of Texas, the University of Tennessee, whether you're at, whether you're at Berea College in Kentucky, you're at Duke, you're at Chapel Hill, whatever college you're at, a lot of colleges are getting money. So that's not their problem. And I'm not saying that these colleges aren't getting money and that they're struggling to necessarily get money. Here's what I am saying. I'm saying that colleges right now, colleges and universities, are in the middle of a 15-year, maybe even 20-year long. I really think it really started in the aftermath of the 2008 recession. If you look at a lot of studies of wages have, for the most part, stayed relatively stagnant since that of the late 80s, early 90s, right? But when the 2008 financial crisis hit, it was a moment of plateau for many Americans in terms of lost pensions, lost 401ks. Sure, I know a lot of people that don't even have pensions because they're like, listen, our companies aren't doing that anymore. So I think 2008 was a really big turning point because I know growing up in North Carolina, it was constantly hammered to us, you will go to college. And there's a lot to that because of society, race, the turn of the 2000s, post Y2K type of era. But there was a lot of emphasis on you'd meet your counselor in high school and they say, have you applied for colleges? Have you done scholarships, X, Y, Z? And many of you listen to this are a part of this. A lot of you know, oh yeah, I went to college because it was hammering in me. You're going to college because that's how you make money. But it's been about 15, 20 years where you're seeing a lot of people saying, I'm not really getting a good ROI on colleges. And it goes back to that analogy I just used with the house. It's one thing if I go to, let's say I go to Target right now and I buy a new speaker. I'm looking for a new speaker. I have a Bose speaker, but I've been looking for a new one. Let's say I buy the speaker. It's $100, $150, and it doesn't work as well as I want. You know what? Maybe it's a one-off. Maybe it's the wrong speaker. You don't think about it. But if I go into a real estate agent and I buy a $450,000 house and I start losing money on that house, it's going to hurt. And that's why I say that's basically colleges right now, because they're in a position where you are spending, you're not spending $4,000, you know, a semester, $5,000. You're taking out $20,000 a semester, a year. You're taking out $40,000 a semester or a year. I'm on Reddit a lot more than ever these days. And then I'm on Reddit and I talk and I see a lot of people that are, yeah, I was 18 years old and I signed to do a $100,000 program at a university in I don't know, middle America, Chicago, whatever the case may be. And within 4 years of graduating, I can't pay the bill. I have a nephew. He went to college for 2 years. The pandemic hit. Went back for like another semester after like a year away and just didn't end up going back. He was only in college for 2.5 years. $45,000 in student loans. My brother took out loans. He's paying $550 a month on student loans. So when people start talking about student loan debt forgiveness, I think about these people because I think colleges right now are at the center. They're in a 15-year long storm, and it's bad for so many different reasons. I asked my girlfriend just the other day because I was like very curious. I wanted to talk about this topic. I asked my girlfriend, I said, hey, have you ever donated? She went to the University of New Mexico. I said, hey, have you ever donated back to the University of New Mexico for any reason? She said, absolutely not. Fuck no. And it was one of those responses that was at her core, she's not going to do it. Went there, paid tuition, got the degree, and she has no desire to give them any more money in the forms of alumni donations. And it's one that you're hearing all across the country from millennials, Gen Z, and all types of constituents. And look, here's the deal. Colleges right now are contending with a couple of different reasons, and that's why they have a donation problem. So look, I'm going to build this bridge here next 3-4 minutes. Stay with me here because I think I set the scene pretty well, but I want to explain it even further here. The number one thing that, from my point of view, colleges are contending with right now is that their alumni group, their base, many of their constituencies that have gone through their various programs don't have any disposable income. You read online over and over and over again that a lot of people that have graduated from colleges, they get out, they have $40,000, $50,000 in student loans. They don't have disposable income. They're working at jobs paying them $23, $24 an hour, and they're not able to make ends meet. So you think I'm going to take my measly extra $300 I have left over and give it to you? The audacity. That's what a lot of people that have gone through these colleges are saying to themselves. I just got finished paying you $45,000, $65,000, $85,000, and now you have the nerve to call me doing a fundraising bonanza trying to get $100 out of me. Screw you. And so if you're that fundraiser, that Reddit fundraiser that I talked about earlier, that's what you're dealing with. The second thing that I think a lot of colleges are contending with right now is sour alumni. And there's many different reasons for that. Again, the money aspect is one, but a lot of it is a lot of people that have gone through colleges and universities, they look back and they go, yeah, the pool was nice and playing intramural sports was nice, but I don't really think I walked away learning anything that put me in a position to properly succeed in this environment. And I'm going to talk about, look, this is not all colleges' fault. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But I think a lot of alumni are just sour. And even the ones that have disposable income to potentially donate are like, like I went to the University of Utah, you know, I went to the University of Nebraska, you know, I went to West Wesleyan and West Virginia. I went to these colleges, whatever the case may be. And afterwards, I'm like, yeah, I met some really cool people, but I'm just a little sour. The third thing, and this is honestly, this could be the number one thing, and I've talked about it already, student loan debt and student loan forgiveness. Colleges right now are at the centerpiece of a lot of those conversations for various reasons. But the amount of student loan debt that continues to rise is so big that you have the Secretary of Education, you have the Vice President, and you have the President of the United States, among others, constantly talking about it. We had a president run, and one of his ordeals in running, Joe Biden, was that he was going to take a close look at student loan forgiveness. And he tried. Yeah, it didn't work. You know, him and his administration, but it did not work. Student loan forgiveness is something that is very, very big. And student loan debt, period, is something that colleges really have to contend with. And that's part of the reason why they have a donation problem. The fourth thing, and I have two more here. The fourth thing that a lot of colleges have to contend with, culture wars. It was not that long ago, I was reporting that many people were displeased with what was happening in Harvard, MIT, and I can't think of the, was it Yale? Was it Princeton? I can't think of the other one, but a lot of people were not happy with a lot of the things that are happening in Israel, Palestine, all the things that are happening there. There's a lot of belief that colleges from both the left and the right are not properly positioned. Now, listen, we know in America, we have a lot of divisive aspects of politics. Either you're over to the side or over on that side. You're either with us or you're against us, right? We know that. And colleges are at the center of a lot of those conversations. Now, they may not want to be at the center of a lot of those conversations, but they are. But they are. And so colleges are really hit with a little bit of a double whammy from individuals, where there are folks that are saying, oh, colleges are not taking a strong enough stance as it relates to Black Lives Matter. They're not taking a strong enough stance when it comes to Jewish independence or individuals of Jewish descent. There are a lot of aspects of colleges that are for people that believe that colleges spend money willy-nilly, that a lot of the administration spends money willy-nilly, that a lot of higher educations don't pay their faculty enough money, that they use adjuncts too much. So there's a lot of aspects where colleges are under a microscope. And one of the things I think a lot of people may not realize, but that's a really fun fact, is that only 37% of Americans over the age of 18 have a college degree, an undergrad degree or higher. 37%. So there are a lot of people in New York City, and there are a lot of people in Paris, Texas, cities that are big and cities that are small that do not have college undergrad degrees or higher. And a lot of those folks feel cheated because they look around and they go, oh, well, you're getting your loans taken care of, but I didn't even go to college. Where's my fucking handout? What do I get? And so colleges right now are really at a position of they're getting hit from all sides. All sides. And the fifth thing that I think, and there's a lot of things, but I think the big five are these five. I think the fifth thing that a lot of colleges are contending with is they're having to focus on alumni or groups in their database or their Rolodex that have money. And this kind of goes back to point number one, where if you graduated from, let's say you graduated from the University of Arizona, I think that's the Wildcats. I always get the Wildcats and the Sun Devils confused. Let's say you went to Tucson and you went to the University of Arizona, you're a Wildcat. You leave with $65,000. There's a lot to that. And you're trying to pay back your loans. Well, you don't have the money to give. So are the colleges going to really try to focus on you? Yeah, maybe a little bit. Yeah, maybe a little bit. But a lot of colleges are having to spend a lot of their energy and time on their alumni base that actually has money. They're spending a lot of their energy and time on foundations or institutions or corporations that have money. And so because of that, there are a lot of alumni that can feel like, oh, I'm not important, even if you can't give money. So listen, I would not want to be a lot of the fundraisers at the ground level for these universities. It's one thing if you're the university president, you have your own issues and stuff like that. Or if you're the leader, a department development head at a university like Cornell or Tulane or Northwestern, whatever. Yeah, that's one thing. But if you are the person having to make phone calls, you're updating your Salesforce or your donor X pages, and you're trying to keep up with all of that you have to do, I can imagine you sweat a lot because you're probably reaching out to alumni that don't have money, and you're reaching out to alumni that do have money because those other alumni don't have money. So I think that's just where it's at. All right, we're back in time for our rapid fire books section for today's episode. And look, my desire is to get you in and out of here in under 10 minutes. I know I went long on that last rant, but yeah, so when it comes to money, colleges, young people, sometimes you just got to talk. And so we're going to get you out of here in 10 minutes. And this is a perfect transition because sometimes a book comes out and it reverberates. And people that get it, fucking get it. And when this book came out, I was in a position, I was going through too much, right? 2018, going through a divorce, separating, trying to figure out who I am, turning 30 in like 2019. So kind of leading up to that, just too much going on. So I did not get a chance to thoroughly read it, but I've had someone in my life that's been telling me about this book for some time. So big shout out to you, Brandon. We used to work together. And so he said, "Swim, you got to read Decolonizing Wealth by Edgar Villanueva." And he's mentioned this a couple of times. And so finally I'm in a position. I'm like, yeah, I gotta read the book. So I go pick it up. He actually let me borrow his book. So again, shout out to you, Brandon. Appreciate it. But I was like, you know what? Two chapters in, I said, I got to buy this for myself because it is that freaking good. And so this book, Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance by Edgar Villanueva. This book came out in 2018. And even, look, I'll be honest, even when it came out, I know a lot of people that were talking about it. And to be a powerful book, you don't need to have, your book doesn't need to be wildly big. It doesn't need to have anything, honestly, it doesn't have to be anything crazy, right? In terms of research or backing, it just has to hit home with a point. And Edgar Villanueva does an amazing job of weaving in so many oddly, what feels like not necessarily different ideas, but connecting what for a lot of people can be different ideas. And so look, let me start with this. Let me start with the book just from the jump. I'm going to put this in the show notes. You can check this out. He has two editions of the book. He has a 2018 and then I think a 2021 edition. I ended up reading the original version. So if you have that second version, it could be, there's some things I'm sure that are added that are not in the first edition. But the book is very, very light, 217 pages, and that's everything. I'm talking index, reference, about the author, conclusion, preface, all intro, all that stuff, 217 pages. It's a paperback book, so it's light. You can put it on the plane with you, which is always a plus, right? I'm reading a book right now called Gray Areas by Addie Harvey Wingfield. It's a paperback. And it's funny how it's the same amount of pages, and yet it's just a little bit heavier because it's paper, or excuse me, it's hardback. But Edgar's book is paperback, easy to read. It's two parts. He has six chapters, and then he has like the second part is a couple of different breakdowns. Kind of hard to explain in that respect, but you get the gist if you get the book. Very, very good formatting. One of the things I always look for when looking at a book, even before we start talking about what's inside and the subject matter, is how does the book actually read physically? Like when I pick it up and I'm looking at it, and I have the physical book here in front of me, very good spacing, good font. Listen, I don't wear glasses or contacts, but my eyes, you know, listen, they want a little bit of help. And so a slightly bigger font. And I appreciate that from the author and the book. I think it's Brett Kohler Publishers. They do a great job of just packing in the information in a format that's easy to read, easy on the eye. So you're always going to get that insights from us here at the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. But the book as a whole, the subject matter is phenomenal. And one of the things that can make a book powerful is just meeting people where they are. And listen, I've talked about this in my private life before. I grew up in Philadelphia. And one of the things growing up in Philadelphia, the city, I think at the time back in the 90s, was like 43% black. I think it's closer to 39% black. Then I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. They are about 35, 36% black, not including surrounding areas and things like that. So I've lived in some places like Philly, Charlotte, North Carolina, spending a lot of time on the East Coast where there are a lot of black people. And a lot of the stories that you would read about indigenous groups, Native American tribes and organizations and collections of people in the East Coast is not that great. It's not that great. And you read, I remember growing up in elementary school, you read in your history books, they'd be like maybe two pages on slavery, and then Abraham freed the slaves, so we got to give him credit. And then there's like maybe three or four paragraphs about the gross displacement of Native American indigenous groups, the gross misjustices to much of society. And one of the things, if you ever get a chance, look at a map of the United States and where black people are highly concentrated. And then look at the map of where indigenous communities are highly concentrated. And you see a bit of a disconnect. And I know there are a lot of people that are in African-American space and in Native American space. There is a level of connection that despite the barriers in terms of physical space or where people may live, there is a strong connection between the two groups because of a lot of injustices. There are a lot of injustices. And so as I'm reading the book, there are a lot of parts where I go, I didn't think about the aspect of philanthropy. And that's what he has a background being in philanthropy, working at a couple of different philanthropy foundations and organizations. And he has that as the kind of the centerpiece, if you will, the intro piece of his book. But so much of what he says, it's in the beginning, indigenous wisdom to heal divides and restore balance by decolonizing wealth. And he's shot up at the forefront. The book is, again, so good. And one of the things, he shines a light, a great light, into the different ways that when you look at foundations, and we're talking specifically foundations, not 501c3 charities, but 501c3 private foundations, he talks about how if you really look at how a lot of foundations even absorbed or gained their money was from the basically the stealing of resources and wealth and thought patterns and ideas from different different groups across the world, but specifically a form of decolonization or colonization where, hey, we are in this land, we're taking what we want, we're getting wealth by taking what we want. And then in turn, if you want some of this wealth that we have to help improve the communities in which you live, you need to come to us and do applications to apply to get the money that really is not even ours. And so many people in the fundraising space know a lot of this, but this book does an amazing job. And I connected with this book on so many levels. First, as a black person living in the United States, and then as a black person who's been very fortunate to live in the so-called Southwest, where there are a lot of people of indigenous backdrop, where I go, yeah, he's speaking to me. And I totally get where he's saying. There are a lot of great lessons in this. And one of the things is, if you are a fundraiser, listen, if you're going to a lot of different foundations that have millions upon billions of dollars, you have to ask yourself, how did they get that money? How did they get that money? And a lot of us know a lot of those organizations got that money from the pillaging of resources, from the land grabbing of different groups, from the enslavement of people, from the profitization of society over poor workers, taking the uses of labor from individuals and using it to gain money. And then you have a stockpile of this money. You say, hey, I'm going to create a nonprofit. I'm going to create a foundation. And then in turn, go into those folks and say, hey, listen, we have $1 million to give out this year. We want you to apply to get this money. there's something up with that. And look, I want to read you two parts here that I think are very, very telling. Then we'll go ahead and get out of here, because this is a book you're going to want to pick up. You can find it on thriftbooks.com. I need to be an affiliate with them because I keep shouting them out too much. But what chapter is this? This is from chapter, let me make sure I got it. Chapter 5. And then he talks about the savior dynamic. And he goes to say that, and I quote, "Because of the power associated with controlling wealth, leaders in institutions of philanthropy and finance are some of the worst perpetrators of the savior dynamic. Despite all of their talk of wanting to help, reform, even revolutionize the world, saviors won't touch the underlying system of privilege and power because that's what grants them their status and position in the world. In the end, saviors don't heal anything. The savior complex often goes hand in hand with white supremacy. Not all saviors are white. Some are people of color and indigenous. People have been infected by the power of dynamic of colonization, internalized oppression." We've talked about savior dynamic at length in the nonprofit space honestly, probably as long as I've been on planet Earth. But it is interesting putting the forefront of indigenous wisdom and insight at the front of the line. And coming really kind of back to that, he does an amazing job in the book of doing it. It's just truly phenomenal. And then there's another part that I want to read real quick. And like I said, we'll go ahead and get out of here, that I really, really love. This is on step 6, page 151, where he says, this is under the invest, where he says, "Since 1969, United States tax law has mandated that foundations pay out a minimum of 5% of their total assets each year in the form of grants or eligible administration expenses. The, quote, payout rule was created to prevent foundations from receiving assets but never actually making charitable distributions with them. The other 95% of assets are invested with the goal of earning financial returns that sustain the grant-making power of the foundation over time." He goes on to basically say this is bullshit. If you have $500 million and you invest that, and we could talk about investing all we want, but you invest that $300 million and every year you get 5% back in money, what is that, $5 million a year that you're getting from investment? Wait, did I do that right? No, that's $25 million. It's too early. Let's say you get 25% in money every year, just investing your money as a foundation. If you give out 5% of that, that's $25 million. What are you doing with the other $475 million? Are you really using that money to transform the landscape of the issues and the problems that have been created through colonization? Are you using the money to change that? Or are you just using that money to kind of have a legacy, have status? Say you have the biggest assets of a money foundation in your state. What are you doing with that other 95%? That's something we're going to talk about probably in another episode of our Uncut series. So listen, check this book out. Pick it up. Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance by Edgar Villanueva. Again, came out in 2018. So glad I read it even today. This is one of the books I'm keeping in my private collection. And this is something that you're definitely going to want to keep in yours. All right, listen, that's enough for today's episode. We'll have future episodes coming out. Be sure to subscribe to us on Apple or Spotify. Keep following us. Keep up with what we're doing. We have interviews, videos, all that stuff coming this spring. So go out there. Enjoy your day. We got the new change with the time. So listen, spring forward, we all lost an hour. So enjoy yourself. Enjoy the week. We'll see you on the next episode.